public meeting. Consumer Affairs Committee, open up a public hearing on 2965. Representative Wilson. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself and just take off.
Chairman Olson, members of the committee, thank you. I come to you with Bill 2965. I am Carl Wilson, State Representative, District 49, Grand Pass, Cave Junction, all of Josephine County. I bring this bill on behalf of the Grand Pass Gospel Rescue Mission, and I think to for other nonprofit missions that operate around the state. Just quickly cutting to the chase, the reason for this bill. This bill is to prevent those who volunteer or donate their services for religious, charitable, or environmental duties, like missions, from claiming unemployment benefits. A little bit about the mission in Grants Pass. It's very typical for a number of missions around the state of Oregon. It is a nonprofit agency and receives absolutely no government money of any kind. It offers legal counseling, job counseling and benefits, clothing, room, board, life skills, all for $20 a day or less. This mission declares as part of its responsibility that teaching those homeless residents of the shelter to work is one of the great responsibilities that they have. They ask the residents who live in the shelter, 80%, by the way, are local people from Josephine County. They ask them to take part in really elemental housekeeping at the very beginning, cooking chores, and gradually work them up to unloading trucks at the warehouse that delivers to a thrift store that they operate locally that supports the mission. Every day, a number of the homeless residents go out to the streets, and instead of panhandling like they used to do, they go out and dig in the streets. They pick up trash and things like that. Most of these people, as you would expect, come from backgrounds of abuse, alcohol abuse, drug abuse. They have burned all the normal bridges to society, and they have hit rock bottom, and they're looking for some place to go. And this mission specializes in success stories. They teach people how to live successfully again. And the mission feels that teaching them to work, teaching them to meet a deadline, teaching them to be at a certain point at a certain time of day and to take pride in a job well done are all part of their mission. We brought this bill forward because several of the individuals, the homeless folks who had moved into the shelter, who decided after being there for a few days that they didn't want to take part in work anymore, decided to leave and go back to the streets, they were threatening to file for unemployment compensation. This is a potential problem that can be very, very severe for mission organizations throughout the state, throughout the country. We talked to Senator Shields about that problem, and of course, as you know, he was concerned with that issue, and he agreed that it was a very dangerous precedent if one of the homeless individuals would have success in getting unemployment compensation. Many of the homeless folks who come to the shelter are there three and four and sometimes five times. That's in the system, back out of the system, before they become successful. Many of them do become successful. But the concern here is that so many are in the system, out of the system, they go back to the streets for a few days or a month or so, and then they come back. But, well, the chief concern has obviously been about them filing for unemployment compensation. So as you can see, the bill reads in the amended section here, employee does not include a person who volunteers or donates services performed for no remuneration or without expectation or contemplation of remuneration as the adequate consideration for the services performed for a religious or charitable institution or a governmental entity. So with that said, I'd be happy to
any questions?
Questions you might have.
Thank you very much. I don't think anybody else signed up for that. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2965. Open up work session on House Bill 2965. Chair moves House Bill 2965 to form two pass recommendation. I'm trying to catch up the time here. The chair was late. Any questions? Comments? Motion carried. Suppose Senator Scheel would like to carry this bill? Okay, well, we have Senator Scheel.
Okay.
Sound good? We'll open up a public hearing on 2020. And Ken, are you Ken Scheel? You're around here someplace? Thank you. And Scott Berry, if you can just be close to hand, that nice guy. Oh, well, wow, wow.
The
heavyweight. I've always told my son to never underestimate the power of a woman. Now there's four of them here. They're all senators.
I got to pick all these bills again.
Well, there's five.
What are you guys here for?
Oh, I came here to support that bill. Please start. Why don't we try and collect ourselves here?
Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association. That's my name, support of House Bill 2020. Currently, contractors must take 16 hours of education. The education is on the business and lien law related topics.
Yes.
That's where contractors tend to fail and have their problems. At least CCB members show that. But contractors that do have business problems, who have problems going out of business, related to their business and not their skills as a contractor. There's no assurance that contractors are learning anything through the current education process, and we've looked at actually as an industry not supporting that education in the future. And another concern that with current system is that not all the education providers are doing a good job of providing the education for the fee that they're charging folks. Problems addressed with this bill with inside 2020. The bill provides a way for us to make sure that contractors receive the important information, which means we may see fewer contractors going out of business. The theory holds true that they're going out of business for lack of business knowledge, and we're actually forcing those folks to learn the information that is required currently by state law. We think that that'll be a positive for our industry. Testing allows the CCB and the industry to recognize those educators who are not providing good information to contractors and paying for the services, and that was something that Chair Cheney with the Construction Contractors Board was concerned about. There are a lot of providers out there that aren't doing a good job. They're charging the contractors a couple hundred bucks, $250 for the education, and in some cases we've actually seen the education, the 16 hours of education, go out and come back on the same day. So they are taped. But it's a little bit hard to believe that someone could go through 16 hours of pace in 8 or 10 hours. So, I think the other thing we hope the test may also serve as a disincentive for the out-of-state contractors looking to move into the state for the summer and who may not have the best intentions in terms of just moving into the state easy target in terms of just registering as a contractor. There's no test currently. And again, this would hopefully provide some disincentive for those folks without making it difficult for someone to simply just get into the industry. Of course, we would certainly oppose. Finally, the bill does change the word registered to licensed. This change would mean that all contractors within the CCB and with CCB oversight would be called licensed. Currently, landscape contractors are licensed contractors as well. AG Council for the construction contractors and support informed the board and the industry that there was no difference in the terms. So whether you are registered or licensed, it doesn't necessarily make a difference one to the other. There's no legal difference in the terms. And again, currently, all folks other than than our group of contractors are licensed by the CCB. We are registered. It does change that term with the test included as well.
Okay.
Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ken, I see you have written, you've submitted a letter and basically you're in support of the bill and aware of no opposition. Is there anything you'd like to add to this?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Ken Kubel, Administrative Construction Contractors Board. It's sometimes scary when you get a bill that's 31 pages that maybe that doesn't do that much in that much change, changing the term license, registered for license on a number of places. But the bill does two things. It changes the term registered to license, and it becomes effective on July 1 of 2000, and on that date, and from there forth, any new contractor coming into the state or wanting to become a contractor in the state will have to pass a test on the 16 hours requirement.
Okay, questions from the committee? Yes.
Tim, the financial that's in here that's going to, the funding that's referenced in here, by Chief.
Chair Nelson, Transavire, yes it is, and the funding is already into our, considered into our budget, which is working its way through.
No problem. Any questions? Close public hearing on the House Bill 2020 and open up a work session on House Bill 2020. The Chair would move House Bill 2020 to the floor with due path recommendation. Comments? Objection?
I object, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that there's, I guess I've been noticing all these wonderful little groups coming up with this either continuing education or new tests they get to take, all in the name, I suppose, of protecting consumers, but it strikes me that it probably protects those who are already licensed. It shields them from any additional competition and also continues to breed, I think, probably extraordinarily lazy consumers who apparently are not capable of asking the question of someone they are about to engage in a contract with whether or not they are qualified to do the job. And if the answer is yes, why? But I guess proposals like this suggest that consumers are just not capable of that kind of inquiry.
So for that reason, I just make this a mistake.
I think that's just in the defining tradition of the Bar Association.
Well, I didn't. I don't want you to believe that I think that their CLE program is going to work.
We better talk to our resident senator contractor guy. Senator Starr.
I think that this really, really does get into a different problem. And that is helping those beginning contractors understand the business side of starting a new business so that they might have a little better chance of success, because most people that enter our business fail early on, and some of them fail more than once before they finally make it. And so I think by having the instruction and the opportunity here up front that we will actually assist you entering some of this business.
Well, let the record show that Senator Miller is in opposition to the motion to...
Did he say that?
He did. You want to maintain
what all that stuff was? Yes.
You're shocked that you aren't joining.
Right. The record show that Senator Miller registered in opposition. Motion carried. Senator Starr, you want to carry this bill? Thank you. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 9. We're doing a work session on Senate Bill 957. We're setting up a public hearing. We have a
work session.
I think we're outnumbered. That's unfortunate.
Well, so welcome, son of
a...
We are having invited guests. We may be crazy, but we're not dumb. Who would like to start off?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. For the record, I'm Avelle Gordley. I represent Senate District 10, which includes neighborhoods in Southeast and Northeast Portland. You'll be hearing from Senator Duke and Senator Shannon on the issues that you're concerned about. Senator Castillo and I need to take off because we've left the men of the Senate Education Committee alone. We need to get back there to make sure that no more damage is done, so to speak. But this is a very serious issue before you today, and we have conversed, and we feel very well represented by Senators Duke and Shannon.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, I'm also in the same community they are. But
could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, Senator Shannon, District 15. And sometimes the women do band together on sort of a women's issue. And although Senator Burdick and Senator Q-Tub could not be here today, is there one more? Anyway, the women would like you to know in the Senate that we do not want to move towards self-serve gasoline in Oregon, and a lot of the elderly do not, and handicapped people, and we have a lot of experience in other states that have self-serve, and we're very proud of our tradition, and we hope that the men only on this committee will think about the women in their lives and not move this bill forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1, and maybe I can put a little history into this, although every time I do this I feel older and older. But when we first established gallonage requirements for businesses and allowed businesses to go to cardlock facilities, it was somewhat reluctant on the part of the legislature, but with the understanding and with the request of business that there were fleets of vehicles out there that couldn't get filled up during the day. In order to make the business work, they needed to keep their vehicles, their trucks, basically on the road all day long. And so they were trying to fuel up in the middle of the night, and in those days, gas stations weren't open in the middle of the night, so they needed some way of being able to fuel up and not take the expensive part of the day out to do that. And so they were given the ability to go to card locks sort of create card locks so that they could do that. It's changed over the years, and we've fought with the gallonage requirements, and we've modified them. The last time we took a serious look at what was a small business, and the legislature made the conscious decision that anything under a certain gallonage didn't have enough vehicles out there to really need the same kind of service that we had provided in the past. And we struggled with that, and we looked at the small businesses. In my community, it was the fishermen. I mean, there, a lot of them are in business for themselves, and they're not working for somebody else, or small businesses. Should they be able to go up and fuel up? And the conclusion for those tiny businesses was, there's, other than giving them something that other people don't have, there's no retail reason to do that. They can fuel up during the day when everybody else does, and they don't have the same need to be out there on the road during the day. In fact, a lot of them, if you go this way, you're probably going to have accountants fueling up their private cars on their way to work. That's the sort of thing we're talking about once you start getting rid of the gallonage requirement for businesses. There are lots of businesses out there that don't fit the model that we normally think of when we think about needing to go to a cardlock facility and fuel up. And if you don't think this will push us to self-serve, you might want to rethink that, because I think it will. You're going to create a very larger, more difficult to defend class of folks who can fuel up on their own. The Fire Marshal's Office can tell you it's tough enough now to differentiate between the people who are fueling their personal cars with those who are fueling their business cars, and I think you're going to make it almost impossible to distinguish if you go to this level. And you heard me on that floor about the seniors and the disabled and a lot of people like us who just don't want to fuel their own cars. And I can tell you, we can say to the cows come home, we will do both, unless you get to the point someday where you can say, and I believe with antitrust we can't, that you have to have both, and one can't be more than a certain percentage higher than the other, self-service versus car lock. And I don't think we can do that. You're going to have very few full service or even mini service. That's where we are in Washington. In terms of saving money, I can fuel up in Salem before I leave on Friday night, or I can pump my own gas in Longview when I get there Friday night on the way home, and I will pay the same amount per gallon.
I just would like to do one thing, and that is that lots of times we check our moral compass before we vote. I think it'd be good to just think, what would my wife want, my mother want on this vote? My grandmother.
Senator Meyer, I have a question here.
Senator, did she address the amount agree with that. Have you looked at page 2, lines 22 and 23? Your experience in dealing?
Well, my understanding was that was coming out. There's, I saw an amendment to delete that in lines 29 and 30 on page 1.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I just wanted to add my name, Kate Brown, the Senate District 7, Northeast and Southeast Portland. I'm just here to stand with my sisters from the Senate in opposition to Senate Bill 957.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
I want to know who put my wife up to putting this.
And not from home.
What does it say?
I think it's a full service going from home.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Duke, you mentioned the accountants that might probably on their way to one of their continuing education classes stuff. Could you describe to me what is the danger that we need to protect the citizens of Oregon from if they were allowed to do that?
I think it's more, Senator Miller, not what is the danger, what is the need. I think we're solving a problem whose need isn't there. What's the difference between the accountant who is in business for himself, who on his way to his continuing education class fills a gift tank, versus the person on their way to the job at the mill who fills up their tank? And it's a matter of the people of the state of Oregon have said no thank you to this, and so I don't see the distinction between those two. One of them has gone into business for himself, and the other one's gone into business working for somebody else. Other than that, I don't think there's a distinction that would require or push us toward there's a need there that we need to let that accountant fill up.
Well, beyond the accountants, someone's desire, whether it's an accountant or lawyer or whatever, to engage in an activity that 48 states believe is perfectly safe and reasonable, what is it that compels you to say that person should not be able to serve themselves? I understand your desire to have others be served, but why is it that you feel it's in the interest of Oregon to prevent those people who care to serve themselves? Why do you prevent that activity?
It's a statewide vote, Senator. I think the people have spoken on the issue of self-serve gasoline.
That's
and they
why
said no.
The kicker as well.
Yeah. If there were a good reason, I think businesses, the larger businesses who have fleets have come in and made a legitimate case, and I supported that. It's when you get down to these levels of things that I don't believe are supportable. I've heard the arguments of, oh, we're going to go out of business if we can't do this, if we can't get cheaper gas. I don't believe it's, well, I think it's the legislature should help business all they can. I don't think it's up to the legislature to try to keep businesses in business who can't financially make it otherwise. But for me, it's the whole self-serve issue. Like I said, I could get there if we could require both, and one couldn't be more than a certain percentage or whatever higher. You heard my story on the floor about getting gas in Washington State, and if they were going to pump it, it was 35 cents a gallon higher. To me, that's not particularly realistic. But if we could get a reasonable figure, but I believe the Antitrust Act won't allow us to, then we would have both.
Well, let me just ask Senator Shannon if I might help me reconcile a certain conflict. You are correct to assert that my mother is not necessarily in favor of self-service, although I don't think she would object to cardlock activity. But my wife and my daughter are absolutely in favor of being allowed to do what did my mother certainly, or my wife has done in other states successfully without damaging her clothes or anything else, and continues to wonder why Oregon is so weird on this particular issue. So how do I go home and tell her that the women of the Senate
supposedly speaking, I guess, for all women, didn't represent current youth.
Well, if you check your thoughts about your wife and your daughter and daughters-in-law and mother, and they all want to pump their own, that's all I ask. I just ask each of you, and if you are in agreement, that's probably what contributes to your happy marriage. So.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been a very important and enlightening.
Bring it up on the floor.
Well, let's see. Do we have a
proposed amendment to 957-1? What are those saying,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee? If you have a copy of the bill, you can look at the effect of the proposed amendment. If you go to page 1 of the bill, section 1, sub 4, has been changed to sub 3, and under the 3 sub B, which says owned and used by the non-retail customer for the business, government agency, or nonprofit or charitable organization. If you remember, the major point of contention during the public hearing was about whether the card lock activities would be involving only those vehicles that belong to the organization or vehicles that belong to the individual that may be used for business purposes. And the amendment basically takes out sub C, which would allow cards owned by individuals that would be used for business activities, organizational activities. And so that portion repeats on page 2 in the middle of the page, and that's a large B, capital B, under the small b, under sub 5 in that section. And that's deleted as well.
Everything else stays. So if you pass the bill with this amendment, the dash 1 amendment, basically what you're doing is, one, repealing the 2,400-gallon limit, which is set now as a requirement for card lock activities. Two, you are eliminating the $5 annual fee, which the fire marshal charges for inspection or safety records related to the non-retail customers, but you are not opening up the gate further to those who qualify to use cards.
Okay, comments on the amendment? The chair would move the dash 1 amendment. Any comment? Discussion? I can't see any there. No votes to the amendment. One. Maybe we better just do a quick roll call vote, please.
Mr. Barr?
Aye.
Mr. Nesbitt?
No.
Mr. Miller?
Aye.
Mr. Starr?
Aye. Aye. Chair moves Senate Bill 957 as amended to the floor of the D-Pass recommendation. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, just in referring to the deference to the updated testimony and other threats.
I don't even know. So we better have a roll call vote. The very front is
no.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Senator Shannon. I'd like to serve notice on behalf of Senator Shannon of a possible minority report.
Okay. Senator Byers joining us. Okay. Senator Hannon will carry this bill.
All good. Both sides.
Okay. Senator. That's good.
You want to do this time?
It's easy to defer.
Sure. I don't know where it is, but I'll carry it.
All right. Let's see where we are here.
Yes. Okay.
Go back to the start here. And open up the work session on 2056. And where are we, Mr. Chair?
Well, Mr. Chair, when you heard House Bill 2056, which is a bill related to the bonding level required of professional contractors, basically the bill increases the required bonding level from what's specified in current statute to a higher level. And it varies depending on the type of work the contractor engages in. The reason why we brought this bill back from work session instead of pass it out in the first hearing is because during the hearing you heard of a proposed amendment from Representative Jensen, who had proposed to significantly increase the level of bonding required of general contractors. Currently, the statute requires $10,000 limit. And that's the surety bond. The proposal in this bill, being the bill's version, is raised to $15,000, and Representative Jensen proposed to increase that to $100,000. There were some discussions, and after the presentations, the committee decided to take some time and look at the appropriate level. What may factor into your decision today would be one, information that Ken Trudell had provided in the testimony, presenting basically some figures and showing you the degree of benefits associated with the level of bonding. And if you would like a refresher, brief refresher of what these dollar amounts are and what is the degree of benefits or beyond certain amount of diminishing returns, which may be helpful to Ken certainly here, and you should have that information in your file. I guess the policy question here is basically the higher level versus the threat or the potential higher barrier for contractors to enter into the field. But the other side of the viewpoint is the higher level of medicine, higher degree of customer protection.
Any comments?
Just for your information, when the bill was discussed on the House side, the committee did seriously look at $20,000 amount for general contractors, eventually adopted the $15,000 amount. And secondly, at one point, the bill contemplated dividing the amount of contract work according to the value of the contract project and use that as a threshold to further delineate the level of bond that would be appropriate. So, for example, if the contract amount is over $200,000 or $250,000, I think is what they consider in the house side, then the surety bond level will be higher, and if it's below, then it's, the bond level would be lower.
Okay. Any comments from the committee on the 15 or 20,000 figure?
Oh, so it's the B6 we're looking at?
Well, you do have a B6.
You have a proposed B6 amendment.
Yeah, that's not a B5.
Which gives you an option to consider, but...
Okay, so we're done with the B5.
I think the B5 they determined that the 100,000 right. was too high to figure that out.
Okay.
Sorry, sorry.
Well, I'd like to point out that we're talking about, as far as claims, a relative handful of contracts, and certainly an even smaller number of contractors. At least I would think it was a smaller number. I don't know that we number of contractors, number of claims shown. But okay. The very small number for the total number that are in the business. And by going from the present level up to 15,000, we've reduced fairly substantially both the dollar loss and the. But I think that
we're just going way too far when we burden an industry that's over.
So you're more comfortable out.
Yeah. Leaving it the way the House sent it over is certainly more than I would really want to go, but I can handle that, I guess.
Is that fine with everybody? Yes. I can, okay, the chair would move House Bill 2056 without any amendments. Has passed by the House. Any comments? And we're leaving the figure at $15,000. Any objections? Okay. And carry a second. You want to carry this one?
I'll do it.
Contractor then. Okay. Thank you very much. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2057. And Kim Cadell and Scott, Gary, please come forth again. Thank you for your patience. We had to do a few of those things in between there.
Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Ken Cudell, Administrator of Construction Contracts Board, giving you some written testimony. Ames wrote House Bill 2057, is legislation proposed by the Construction Contractors Board, amended to deal with the concerns of the House Committee on Consumer Affairs. The bill passed by 56 in favor, 0 opposed in the House. The bill has the support of the construction industry, and I'm aware of no opposition. The bill contains 8 sections. Each of those sections does an amendment. It's a combination of a lot of things. And very briefly, the first section deletes a notarized requirement that has been obtained for contractors when you figure 7,000 people every year having to get a piece of paper notarized. This deletes that requirement. Section 2 on page 2 clarifies that an increased bond can be required on registrants as well as applicants, and this has caused some problems where excessive claims get filed, and we can require a increased bond for people who are wanting to be registered, but if they're currently registered, we first have to take away the registration. Section 3 on page 3 clarifies when a civil penalty can only be $1,000. And what it says, the amendment would make it clear that if it's the first offense and no consumer has been harmed, then the civil and a contractor working while not registered, first offense, no consumer has been harmed, the civil penalty would not be over $1,000. It wasn't clear. It isn't clear with the present wording. Section 4 on page 4 allows the board to revoke, suspend, or refuse to issue or refuse to reissue a registration to an applicant or registrant when they've been convicted of certain crimes. And there's a provision in the Oregon law that's in the 670.280 that says that this has to pertain to that occupation and to that particular license. So that protects us from just basically saying if you committed this crime, you can't be a registered contractor. We first have to determine that it relates to the license that they want to have. Section 5 on page 7 clarifies when the board can perform arbitration. It had the authority to do arbitration for a number of years. This is some clarifying language. Section 6 on page 7 enables the DEQ to take away a contractor's license to put in septic systems if the Construction Contractors Board has already taken away their registration because failure to pay bonds or pay civil penalties. Section 7 on page 7 makes intentional use of another contractor's registration number without authorization, or use of a contractor's registration number with or without authorization with the intent to deceive the public, it makes it a misdemeanor. And a misdemeanor means that it could be a couple $1,000 fine, and it could be up to six months in jail. It's a Class B misdemeanor. Right now, it's a misdemeanor to work while not registered. This adds 2 other reasons why you could commit a misdemeanor. And probably the most important section of this whole bill is Section 8. in that it enables the Construction Contractors Board to place a contractor on probation if three claims are filed in a 12-month time period and the board determines that there's some validity to the claim. This will allow us to hopefully eliminate some of those big-time situations where consumers lose real big. But more importantly, I think it will allow us to sit with the contractor and make sure that the contractor who is in problem knows it and makes some plans to correct their problem. We can put them on probation. We can take away the registration if they can't live with the conditions and correct the problem. We believe, a very good bill. It's probably the most important legislation that the Special Contractors Board has proposed this year or for several years, and ask that you give it favorable consideration.
Scott Barrett, the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I'm just here to offer support for this bill. It's really the last in a number of bills brought to you by the industry and the Construction Contractors Board, and attempt to bring the statutes up to date and add some additional consumer protection as well.
Questions at this
time? I got one.
Yes.
Just curious, since we just changed registration to licensure in the other bill, now that we're changing, we're talking about using registration numbers and present any kind of conflict, because we will have licensure instead of registration once this is signed.
Chairman Wilson, Senator Mitchell, I'm not sure how they deal with that. Is there some conforming language that somebody drafts at the end of the session to deal with that? I'm not sure how they do that.
I
don't think it's a major problem. I don't want to get you scared, but I was just kind of curious about that.
It is. It's one where I wish that we could do something in Oregon, perhaps to take away the term registration whenever we're talking about something like construction contractors or anything like this, that it is a license, not a registration, and get rid of the word. Because it is, if you look, we could spend the session probably just looking at that, the use of the two terms in language. It's confusing.
I think it just means, Mr. Chair, that we'll probably be back next session with the cleanup language.
Well, we should probably say chair over there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, in fact, this morning, if you go back to House Bill 2023, which we just adopted, which basically changes legislation to a licensing. I had a conversation with Mr. Tudell about Section 19, and in it, he uses the term registration many times, while the rest of the bill basically changes registration to a license. And so we talked a little bit about the clarity or the lack of clarity and lack of consistency in the use of language. And if you would like, I'd be happy to follow up with Lex Counselor and figure out if this is something that needs to be corrected. And if not, certainly there needs to be some follow-up effort on their part after session for sure.
Any further questions? We have Doug Hinkle and Kim Hurt. Oh, no, that's not it. Look at that somewhere. I'm sorry. Okay, I just happened to be looking. There are no further witnesses in this. So we probably better check this out, and can we bring it back Friday?
I think we can pass this out, and if we need to make any changes, we can reconsider it on Friday.
Okay.
We'll have time to notify.
Okay. That sounds good. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2891, is that? 2057. Open up a work session on House Bill 2057. Chair moves House Bill 2057 to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. Okay, I'll pick that on the show. You carried all the tough bills, isn't open up a public hearing on House Bill 2891. And who do we have is our... Okay, Larry Eisenberg, Ken Stillman, Doug Hinkle, and Jim Hurt. You can all kind of gather up around here close. Welcome, gentlemen. Get to this committee in great shape. Who would like to start here?
Chairman, I would.
My name is Larry Eisenberg. I am the facilities manager for Washington County. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. We are here today in support of House Bill 2891, and we're here as part of the Public Contracting Coalition. The coalition is basically a group of public owners, contractors, organizations representing architects, construction management consultants, a wide range of folks that care about the construction management industry. The full list of the coalition membership is attached to my testimony that's being passed out. We're going to do this as a group presentation. Appearing with me today is Ken Solman from the Oregon Department of Transportation, Doug Hinkle from the bonding industry, and Jim Hurt with AGC to talk about this bill. Back to the Public Contracting Coalition, the coalition was formed in the spring of 1996 to address issues related to the construction manager, general contractor concept of doing construction. The coalition meets regularly to share information about public contracting issues. And last fall, the coalition was asked to consider issues related to design build. For the most part, as you're aware, public agencies use the traditional low-bid method of contracting for public construction. However, again, as you're aware, government looks to be more efficient. Design-build is an attractive alternative in some limited cases for work that needs to be done, as is the CMGC approach. Design-build has been used very frequently in the private sector, and now we're looking to use it more in the public sector. Basically, in the design build, the public entity contracts with a single team to provide design and construction services. We believe that the design build approach, when appropriate, offers many advantages, including an opportunity to be innovative in the construction process, certainly an opportunity for speed, and very often cost savings as well. Design build is a tool in the toolbox of a public facilities manager, an important one that needs to be available. Just by way of example, Washington County is just completing a $20 million operations transportation facility. We did that as a design build. It's taken us only 11 months from contract to completion on that particular facility. It would not have been possible using design bid build. House Bill 2891 provides an important clarification for the contractual relationship between the parties in a design build project delivery system. Basically, the bond requirements for public construction will remain in effect under 2891 when we use design build. It provides a simple clarification that will allow us to choose this and still protect the public interest. I ask your support for House Bill 2891. Would welcome the opportunity for questions as my partners complete their testimony. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to come here today and speak in front of you. My name is Ken Stoneman. I'm the construction engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as was just briefly described to you, House Bill 2891 clarifies the requirements for contractors' performance bonds on public works contracts using the design-build method of contracting. A little background. During the 1997 legislative session, some legislators expressed interest in having ODOT use the design-build method of contracting for a number of our projects. This method is new to the highway construction industry, although it has been used in building construction. But some of the other states around the country were just starting to use this design-build method on a select number of their projects. Prior to the final passage of ODOT's budget last session, a budget note requiring ODOT to complete 15 design-build projects were in that budget note. Even though the note was later removed, ODOT recognized the interest in having that design-build done and embarked on a number of pilot projects to learn more about the benefits of using this new contracting method. During the past 18 months, we have worked extensively with various construction industry groups to address how design-build process would affect project selection, solicitation, contracting, and contract administration. The two pilot projects we have underway have taught us a lot about the design-build method of contracting, and as a member of the Public Contracting Coalition, ODOT decided to take some unresolved issues needing statute modification and clarification to the Public Contracting Coalition for Solution. And House Bill 2891 is the result of that coalition's work with the stakeholders. And ODOT, as well as the other members of the PCC, agree that House Bill 2891 addresses those concerns. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
We'll probably get to them after we get to panel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Hinkle. I am employed in the bonding industry and am here as a part of the Public Contracting Coalition in support of HB, House Bill 2891. Under a traditional project, which is designed by one firm and built by another, each entity provides assurance to the owner of the public entity that the project will be completed as promised. For the designer, professional liability insurance is acquired, and under the statutes governing architects and engineers, their liability does not sunset or close until 7 years after the project's completion. For the contractor, a bond is secured that assures complete performance of the work, and in addition, the contractor is required to be liable for the project through any warranty period on the project. Insurance is covered by premiums, and certainly there's an assessment of risk. If a claim is made against an insurance policy, the insurance company pays the claim out of the premiums collected from numerous policyholders. The insurance premiums may rise due to that claim or several claims, but no direct payment of the claim is required by the design firm itself. Further, a professional insurance policy can cover many projects with virtually no limit to the number and value of those projects. Bonds, on the other hand, are based on the creditworthiness of the contractor and its ability to cover any claims made against the bond. When a claim is made against the bond, the bonding company pays the claim, but then goes back against the bonded contractor for full reimbursement. A contractor's ability to pursue work is directly related to how much work the contractor can bond. Until projects are completed and bonds are released by the owner, a contractor may be unable to pursue additional work. Under a design-build contractor or contract, the owner or public entity is still provided the protection of both the designer's insurance and its seven-year statute of repose, and the contractor's bond and its effectiveness until the project is complete. However, due to current statutory language, it is not clear that the contractor's bond is not also tied to the seven-year statute of repose. As mentioned earlier, a contractor's bond is released from a job, or until a contractor's bond is released from a job, the amount of its bonding capacity is not available to pursue other work.
Chair Nelson and members of the committee, my name is Jim Purdy. I'm president and principal owner of Kalamic Construction Company. I'm co-chair of AGC's Public Contracting Committee and a member of the Public Contracting Coalition. I'm also a member of the board of the CCB and currently serving as secretary of the Oregon Columbia chapter of AGC. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2891, which clarifies for all parties how a performance bond applies to the design aspect of a public improvement project. The current law is confusing as it relates to the separation of the requirements for design error and omission insurance versus the requirements for performance bonds of construction. House Bill 2891 will simply clarify that confusion. But the bill before you today, as the previous members of this panel have mentioned, is a consensus bill brought before you by the Public Contracting Coalition, something that we're very proud of. All stakeholders had spent many hours trying to determine what is best for the construction industry. This bill will help smaller construction companies be able to participate in this type of contracting method. This bill maintains the protections currently provided to public owners through the performance bond and errors and omission insurance. This bill will save taxpayers money when public agencies choose the design-build method of construction as an alternative contracting procedure. And with that, I will conclude, and we will open up the panel for questions from the committee.
It's how many instances will a public entity go to the design build? Is this going to become a sort of a thing they're going to do, or how is that going to work out? And what kind of projects are particularly suited to the design build?
Chair Nelson, will depend a little bit on the method of construction. I can speak for ODOT and how we look at how this would impact our work for transportation projects. And that we see this method being used for a small number of projects. The advantages do not lend themselves to the majority of our projects. Typically, it's complex jobs that innovation from the contractor's involvement in the design is where the payoff would come. Maybe Larry could speak as far as other companies.
Chairman, on the building side, construction of facilities, design build is something that works for projects that are relatively straightforward kind of projects where you want speed, you want innovation, and you want a cost savings at the same time. Design good build works well and delivers most projects for the state, and probably will continue to deliver most projects for the state. But there's some projects where it really makes sense because of the requirements of the organization to use this kind of approach. I would guess that we'll probably see 20% perhaps of the projects falling into an alternative delivery system, which would include CMGC and design build.
And an example, you talked about your...
We're building it's a tilt-up concrete building, 80,000 feet, that's housing our road department and our fleet management function. Relatively straightforward office design, not a very complex building, something that we need badly to replace outdated facilities. So it's something that it makes sense to take advantage of this kind of approach, bring in one team to do the simple design and the rapid, straightforward construction.
Okay. To kind of get this straight in my mind, you under the old, if you have a design then bid build, there's a cutoff point for the designer, or he stays. The designer stays on for a period of 7 years, and the contractor gets off his bond at the end when the project's completed. Design build, you're there all the way down the line, so you want to cut that off, and so that the bonding capacity is released, but then you go to errors and emissions policies that
cover the designer.
Exactly. The designer. Okay. Any questions? Good, very good. Thank you for your testimony. We don't have anybody else there. So the public hearing on House Bill 2891. Open up a work session on House Bill 2891. Chair would move House Bill 2891 before with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? Ordered, and I'll carry that one too. That's kind of an interesting one. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2574. Bob Shiprack. And Representative Gardner, Tamara. Okay. Mr. Shipper, wow, I haven't seen you for a while. Where have you been? We're not going to go there.
Oh, that's a quiet. I'm Bob Shiprack, Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I thought,
what's even bothering you?
And at the request of us, Representative Dan Gardner submitted this bill, and I'm going to defer to the good representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, State Representative from House District 13 in Portland. And House Bill 2574, simply states that on public improvement projects that you have to demonstrate that you have a drug testing program in place. And part of the reason I agreed to sponsor it was I've worked in the construction trade for about 22 years. I really like going home to my wife and kids. It's a very dangerous profession, and accidents can happen where people can be severely injured, and certainly don't want to see that happen due to anyone's negligence on this particular part. Department of Administrative Services has a policy in place that's a zero-tolerance policy for drug use, and I just think that we need to extend this on as well to public improvement projects. There was no opposition in the House on this bill. It passed out of the House 52-0, and just urge your support of the bill.
Thank you. Want to add anything onto this?
Yeah, I was going to say a few words. Mr. Chairman, I wanted it's kind of funny for me to sit here promoting this bill when this
this body, the legislature, has wrestled with drug testing issues for about 12, 15 years in the House Labor Committee when they first started working on this. A lot of resistance, a lot of suspicion about the whole area of drug testing in the workplace. Finally, one of, I think, the big things that happened is the federal government several years ago mandated drug testing programs on certain construction projects that were federally funded or were engaged in interstate commerce, such as pipelines, transportation projects. I was told this week that a lot of the ODOT projects are requiring this because of federal funding that's involved in this. So the industry as a whole, both labor and management, kind of rolled up their sleeves. There was a very tortured history of trying to put together these drug testing programs to ensure confidentiality and fairness and a recognition that people that did have problems also had a right to rehabilitation. And we slowly put those together so that today the industry has these programs in place. The other thing that has spurred the activity in drug testing, however, is private sector owners increasingly demanded it on their projects. Private owners who had an interest in seeing that their job sites were safe and people not using drugs demanded it as part of their contracts, that the contractors have drug testing programs. So once the owners started requiring it, then we followed. They have a lot to say about what goes on. One of the things that, however, has spurred this bill, despite a lot of activity in the private sector, there's virtually no activity and certainly no mandate for public sector owners, which is kind of interesting. So what you've got now are people. There's a perception, and I think it's a reality, that some workers frankly work on the public works projects because there's no requirement unless the general contractor has a policy, and that happens occasionally, that there's a drug test on that project. So you've got people that now work a lot of public works and do their drugs, and this has caused our employers and my affiliates to seek this legislation, and what's good for the private sector and promoted by the public sector, they should put the money where their mouth is. Again, this was unanimous out of the House. Then advised that was a gentleman from the AGC who was going to be here couldn't make it. I can use AGC support for this in the House. Sean Miller with the Associated Builders and Contractors supports the bill. The only thing I want to add on the record is I want to point to some language because I was thinking about going to ask you, and I talked to Dugan Petty with DAS, and one of the things that we had a concern about is there's nothing I hate worse than trying to get some legislation passed that isn't enforced, and it happens too often. And we didn't want the contractors to simply throw a piece of paper on the desk that when they've got the bid and say, this is my drug testing program, and that they've never tested anyone and have no intentions of testing anyone for drugs. But I feel confident, I want to get this on the record, that in line 16, where it says that the contractor shall demonstrate that a drug testing program is in place, means that there's something more than just giving them a piece of paper, that they have to demonstrate that, in fact, the employees at one time or another have been tested. The reason that we've kept the language the way that it is in this and simply didn't say you're going to have a pre-employment test on every job is we move from job to job to job, and frankly, a few years back, that was in fact happening. My people were getting tested twice a week at $30 a pop. That didn't make a lot of sense. So some of the organizations have actually went to random computer-generated, call it a solicitation, and you're advised that you've been randomly selected to go to a licensed testing facility and take a test. They then issue the card that you carry with you and show that you've been tested. And as the industry has evolved, other large general contractors, for instance, will recognize other contractors' drug testing programs as well. So there's a variety of programs out there, and they didn't want to ruin that that's taken years to accomplish, but I just wanted to state for the record that our belief, our intent is that shall demonstrates means more than just waving something in your hand.
I think this probably does create an affirmative duty on the part of the public contractor as well, that you would, in a civil matter, you could point to the law and say, well, you are required to do this. You know, so there may be a compelling evidence of negligence on their part.
I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Any questions? That's it, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So, if no other witnesses, close the public hearing work session on House Bill 2574. Chair would move House Bill 2574 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Comments?
Mr. Chairman, I've only commented. One of my favorite speeches in the last week or two when the Senate floor was made by the senator from Clackamas, I believe it is, Senator Duncan, in which after he spoke for a couple of minutes, he concluded that the bill before him was entirely meaningless, and therefore he was persuaded to vote yes. Now, this is more than that. I want to credit the sponsor and Mr. Shipwreck for being here and supporting us. I intend to agree with what you said about the affirmative duty, but as I read this, it simply says that there's a program in place. It doesn't talk anything about the specifics of the program, about consequences for failure, about when they're administered. It's, I guess, in the nature of a good start, and I don't know whether rules are going to be developed or maybe companies will develop policy, and that's where all the fighting will take place. But this in and of itself, I'm not sure, is as strong as I would like, and I noticed in the amendments they took out at least a portion of the test that could affect the safety of the workplace as well. But just raise that. I support the bill.
Okay. On the record. Any further comments? The motion is to move House Bill 2574 to floor with a due pass recommendation. Objections? None. So ordered. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2320. Okay, Jennifer Weber, Tim Redbush, and Lisa Huffman, please. I didn't see who was for who was. I guess we got everybody together. We've got the fours and the against up here. We're hoping they're all getting along. Yeah. Let's see.
Tim Nesbitt had to leave.
Oh, okay. That's good. So who's the proponent of this bill? Well, would you please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and AOI represents about 19,000 employers, and our members employ 30% of Oregon's private workforce. We're here today in support of House Bill 2320. This bill comes, as it comes to you today, as the result of a lot of work performed in the House. The bill, as originally proposed, dealt with things that we found quickly attracted a lot of attention, like evidence, rules of evidence, and public records laws, and things like that. And so while the bill was in the House, AOI worked with Oregon OSHA and Legislative Council to come up with the proposal, that the bill that's in front of you today, which passed the House 57-0. What we asked of in the bill is that currently Oregon has a program set up that in Oregon OSHA that allows consultation. And what that does is an employer can call and have a consultant come through without risk of penalty and advise them on occupational health and safety issues. And those reports don't have to be disclosed to anybody. They are the employer's property. And they don't have to be given to an OROSHA inspector should the inspector show up after a consultation. However, there are also many other avenues available to employers, and the more people that you have in and take a look at a work site, the better decisions you can be made, because the rules are not specific. And so many of the Oregon OSHA rules are subject to interpretation, that the more eyes you have come in and look at a workplace, the more ideas you can have for new ways of, or ways of preventing injuries. But the problem is that if an employer hires a private consultant or uses a consultant through any of the many insurance companies, such as workers' comp carriers or liability carriers, if they do the same type of assessment and consultation and hand that report over to the employer, presently that's not protected, and Oregon OSHA compliance officers could come in and request and receive copies of those reports. So what this bill does is treat those reports in the same manner as reports done by Oregon OSHA consultants are treated. And the purpose is to encourage employers who are to some degree are reluctant to use other sources for safety consultations because of the fear that it will be used against them in an OROSHA proceeding. The point of the bill is to provide no more and no less protection to the employer with the use of those reports than they have with the same reports conducted by Oregon OSHA. Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Nelson and committee members. For the record, my name is Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys and the Workers' Compensation Section of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. With me is Mr. Randy Elmer, the head of our organization and section, and an attorney who practices here in Salem. I'm here in opposition today to House Bill 2320, and we believe that the bill, as it's written, will have some unintended consequences. I say unintended because I believe that if the bill truly did what Ms. Trussell said that it did, then we would not oppose the bill. But let me tell you why we oppose it and what we believe those unintended consequences are. We in no way want to diminish the ability of responsible employers to provide safe workplaces for their employees. But because of the specificity of the exclusion that the bill that is designated in the bill, we believe that it would potentially carry that exclusion over into ORS Chapter 656, which is our workers' compensation laws, and it would make these voluntary safety consultations unavailable in a worker trying to prove the compensability of their workers' compensation claim, particularly in an occupational disease claim. And I have a discussion of that in the written testimony that I provided to you. But let me give you an example of how this might work. It's example number 3 in the written testimony. Let's say an assembly line worker has suffered various ride-on conditions that appear to result from strenuous, repetitive activities performed in an awkward physical position. A report prepared by a nurse consultant hired by the employer prior to the filing of the worker's claim contained recommendations that the claimant's particular job that be modified to avoid this inevitable injury. And this case did happen, was described to me by one of our members, and the report generated by that nurse consultant was crucial to proving the compensability of the workers' compensation claim. It was not a report that arose from the investigation of the injury. It was a consultation that the employer had. The employer did not remedy the workplace, did not modify it for that worker, and as a result, the worker did suffer a compensable workers' compensation claim. I would also like to point out that under Oregon's workers' compensation laws, the statute contains criminal penalties for workers who knowingly make false statements to the Workers' Comp Board, to the director, to the of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or to the agents of those bodies. There is no reciprocal penalty for employers who are not truthful. And by allowing a privilege around these consultations for employers, we are furthering employers' ability in hindering the truth in workplace accidents, and we don't believe that that is fair. And we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Do you want to testify, or you?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Randy Elmer. I would just want to add that if Section 2 of HB 2320 and the Subsection 2 of that section simply was very specific to say that those consultation reports that arise in the context of Chapter 654 were not required to be disclosed within any other proceedings in 654. It was very limited, very specific. We would probably have no objection. But the way it's written now is that those reports arise out of any investigation, inspection, or administrative proceeding under 654. It goes on to broadly state that that employer for which that consultation occurred may refuse to disclose and prevent any other person from disclosing that safety and health consultation report without qualification. Our workers' comp statutes have very broad discovery rules, what we call full disclosure. So they're written very broadly, as are the enacting Oregon administrative rules that require full disclosure. If we end up in an argument in front of the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, you may know that under rules of statutory construction, very specific statutory language will control over the broad general language. So if the argument is made that, well, you are not entitled in the context of the full disclosure rule, those general statutes of work comp, to reports that were very specifically described in this section, then this very specific section would control over the general. This is creating a privilege that would probably be exercised in third-party cases as well as workers' compensation cases, and that's our fear. That's why we oppose it. Thank you.
Do you have any response to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, this bill is intended to give the same protection to consultants' reports who are hired or work through carriers other than or OSHA, the same protection as the report if it was written by an or OSHA consultant. And it is our understanding and belief that that's what the bill does. We believe it's clear in that Section 2 where it talks about proceedings under 654.
Jennifer, would it be correct to assume that you didn't testify on this bill or these concerns before the House committee or before the vote in the House?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, we did. And we did express our concerns, and the bill was amended with that intent. But as we stated, I believe that on the vote in the House, the people who voted truly believed that they were giving no more protection to these private consultations than to the OSHA consultations. And had that been the case, as we stated, we would not be opposing the bill. But because we believe that the language doesn't quite get us there, that's why we are opposing.
One other question I have, and I never answered, so maybe Lisa, as you know, the current chief executive has had an extraordinary record of support for the trial lawyers of Oregon. Do you know what his view is on this particular bill in its current form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I don't know what his view is on this current bill. I do know that OSHA is not opposed to the bill.
Thank you.
Well, OSHA has a, don't they have a compliance division within their organization? They're allowed to, I mean, employers can come in and ask for a consultation. How does this bill affect that?
This bill, you're right, there's two sections in Oregon OSHA. One deals with compliance. They're the people that come out and cite you and ticket you if they find something wrong. Another section is the consulting department, consultation. And those are the ones that an employer can call up voluntarily and have come out and do an assessment of their workplace and make recommendations. And those reports that consultant from OSHA generates, an employer is not obligated to give
under the to the compliance table. However, that's not the case if you would hire, say, your liability carrier has an expert on fire prevention and you have them come out and do an assessment or do a comprehensive safety review of your facility. That consultation does not have the same protection as a moral OSHA consultation.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, the testimony on the House side discussed these consultations in the context of a willful violation under the OSHA statute, Chapter 654. So if an employer knew that a problem existed and then OSHA comes in and cites them, then that penalty could range from $5,000 up to $70,000. And I think that's kind of the exception, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, but that's the employers want. What they want, the OSHA consultations cannot be used against the employer in establishing a willful violation of four OSHA rules. And that's the protection that they want in this bill. But we believe that this bill is more broad than that.
Okay, so you'd like some clarification. Any further comments?
I'd be concerned about that. I'm not sure if I'd be smart as those of you who remember the bar, but I certainly would be sympathetic to the intent of the bill, but this is the first time I've read some of these concerns about the scope of it, and I think I personally would want more information.
I think what we should do is take some time. We're having Friday meetings set up, and I think Sherry could check this out and discuss with you folks what do you think you can clarify in language, because by and large you are basically in agreement with a lot of the intent of the bill.
Absolutely. We would not object to the bill if we believe that it was true to its intent.
Okay.
Can I make a suggestion, Mr. Chair, too? Just as a suggestion, if in fact there's a scope issue here, since the intent seems to be agreed upon, and because we do close down on Friday, be sure you draft that amendment. If there is, what could be one, I mean.
Yeah, Lisa, do you have a...
Well, just in closing comment, we just want the same protection, regardless of who we have come out and do the consultation.
If
they can currently get the OSHA consultant report for the workers' comp trial that they've just referred to, then all we're saying is the same protection. And if they can't get it, they won't get it under this either.
Okay. So you need some clarification. So we'll work on that and try and we'll put this into work hearing on Friday if we can come to some agreement.
Sure. Could I just make a request for witnesses here? Could I ask Coleman to mark up the bill as it stands now to reflect what you think is desirable from your viewpoint? And I'll take a copy of that and go have a discussion with Metro Council right away.
Absolutely. So, we'll be happy to work with you.
And certainly in that discussion, ensure that the intent of the OI is addressed and it's not addressed. Actually, you can join us at that conversation if you can write about it that way. Is that okay?
Thank you. That was a public hearing or work session. Well, that was a public hearing. Okay, we open up a...
We just have one issue that needs to be discussed really quickly.
Okay.
And it relates to Friday. Equity relates to House Bill 35201, which the committee considered and had on Monday. But the deadline for drafting the bill is either Thursday. And yesterday, the proponents of the bill came with an additional request. So in order for us to not suspend rules, if the committee would just put on notice that it intends to, or you intend to reconsider House Bill 3501 on Friday, it will be noticed, and we'll bring an amendment back to the committee for consideration. That's the dead body, so.
It might be a dead bill if you don't do it. Dead body, just a dead bill by Friday.
Do we have to do anything else? Or is that?
Okay.
On Friday, we probably will have some bills that will be requested to be moved to other committees. We'll try and get the information to each member as to which ones those are. You can make up your mind as to how you want to.
Okay.
Friday will be our last meeting. Any further questions?
I got tears in my eyes.
Meeting adjourned.
All right.